Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking. Today I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a woman who has been an author since the age of 23. She also writes for stage, screen and radio. She's won heaps of prizes and been on masses of shortlists. The prizes she has had for her last novel, Room, include the Hughes and Hughes Irish Novel of the Year and the W.H. Smith Paperback of the Year. Room was also shortlisted for both the Man Booker Prize and the Orange Prize for Fiction. I'm here with Emma Donoghue. She is the one. And she won the Irish 2011 National Lesbian and Gay Federation Person of the Year Award. Emma is Irish and lives in Canada with her partner Chris and two children. She's here to talk about her latest book, Frog Music. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Emma.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, to important matters, and I know last night you had your book launch and it wasn't a normal book launch at all. Can you tell us where it was and what happened?
It was extraordinary. I suppose the element of burlesque in the novel just inspired them to new heights, because we had a hula hoop dancer, we had me reading sort of in character as Blanche, the erotic dancer who narrates my novel, we had an actress playing the character of Jenny Bonnet, the cross-dressing frog catcher whose murder inspired this novel, and we had spontaneous bar fights, and it was all in an extraordinary subterranean Chinese speakeasy near London Bridge. So I didn't know launch parties could be like this.
So it was a massive success then.
It was. I think what's great fun about this novel is that the atmosphere of 1870s San Francisco seems to be appealing to people so much that they're having enormous fun exploring, you know, the music of the times. We had a great playlist featuring some of the 30 or so songs that are in the book. The book is absolutely full of performers, you know. Jenny, the young murder victim who inspired this book, she was a child actress gone wrong. Blanche, a dancer, her man Arthur had been a trapeze artist. So everyone in the book is a show-off of one kind or another. And there's a huge amount of performing and singing and, you know, people hiding their true selves.
Now, it's set in San Francisco. And what year is that then?
1876. It's closely based on history, but I think if you not only gather a lot of historical information, but really work it, you can produce a novel which is very satisfying at the level of plot and character, as well as being true to history. I just love that double challenge. My fiction is typically quite inspired by fact, and I don't find that the facts limit me. I find that they stimulate my imagination.
Because these people really existed. How much do you really know about them?
I know a lot of little interesting bits and pieces. Like, for instance, when Jenny was shot through a window, it was the window of a grimy little bar in the outskirts of San Francisco run by a family called the McNamaras. And of course, I don't know any deep down stuff about what their marriage was like or how they felt about their children. But I know things like, you know, if I try and figure it out that they were renting out the front room, I'm thinking they must have been making some of the children sleep on the porch. And, you know, the children were said to be in school, but there was no local school. So I think the McNamaras were lying to the census man about their children being in school. I know that Mrs. McNamara was illiterate from the census returns, and I know things like how much money they had. So, you know, factual sources such as census or city records or the inquest of after Jenny's murder, they give you just wonderful little pebbles of information from which you can spin entire storylines.
Fascinating. The book starts with a murder, as you say. Tell us about Jenny Bonnet.
Well, she had been a child actress with her French theatre parents, but she seems to have gone off the rails and been sent off to a sort of borstal. There was a horrible institution called the San Francisco Industrial School, which took kids in from age 3 to 20 and kept them locked up for years, really, and it was very abusive. But Jenny worked as a shepherd and then as a frog catcher. So extraordinary jobs for a woman. She was a highly successful catcher of frogs. You know, she'd turn up at the restaurants with a bag of live frogs and sell them. And then she used to get regularly arrested for continuing to wear trousers as she swaggered around San Francisco. So she was a well-known character. And San Francisco was a city of characters. Yeah. It was full of eccentrics. And as a city, it quite prided itself on being, you know, the city of freedom, the city of eccentricity, up to a point, of course. And clearly, Jenny made enough enemies that somebody shot her through a window.
these characters are French. Were there many French immigrants there?
There were quite a few, not massive numbers, but they had a big influence. They tended to run the arts of pleasure. They tended to run the restaurants, the bars, the brothels, the theatres, the dance shows. So, they kind of cornered that particular market.
Lucky them.
It's true. This cluster of French people, they all lived in Chinatown. So they were sort of like bohemian whites who went slumming and lived in Harlem. You know, they seemed to have liked being within this rather lawless ghetto area, because Chinatown, it was a classic ghetto in that the city didn't provide policing or didn't provide any rubbish pickup services. And then, of course, the whites would say, oh, Chinatown is dirty and criminal. So it was a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, yeah. And in 1876, there was not only a record-breaking heat wave, but also a smallpox epidemic. Again, I was put onto this by just a tiny mention in the sources of Arthur Blanche's handsome ex. He was lightly pocked from a recent smallpox attack. So I looked it up and found that the city was absolutely terrorized by smallpox that year. And, you know, people would refuse to let somebody get on the streetcar if they were carrying a bag of laundry. There was this terror of the spread of germs. So I didn't need to invent any of the things that were making the atmosphere tense that summer. There was a lot of anti-Chinese tension and rioting, for instance. People afraid the economy was just about to implode. So it was a thrilling time and place to write about. And one thing I really enjoyed exploring was the issue of babies and what to do with them. Because, again, Blanche, in the inquest documents, she makes a brief reference to having this baby who's gone missing, whose father, Arthur, has taken him away. And I started looking into the question of what you did with your baby if you were an unmarried woman in San Francisco or in any big city. And I found these appalling places, familiarly known as baby farms, where you'd leave your baby, you know, for months on end. And they had two rooms. And one room was for those who were being paid for by the week. So, you know, the staff had some motivation to keep feeding them. And the other room was for the babies who were all paid up. So just they'd been handed over with a lump sum at the beginning. And that was, you know, slow infanticide. So obviously researching some of these things would just make your hair curl. But I just seemed to find it very satisfying to work on this kind of really, really dark material and to see if I can craft a story out of it which won't be depressing.
Yes, no, definitely.
RadioGorgeous.com.
The novel has a wonderful louche grubbiness, all stained bodices, whiskey, bawdy songs and sex. You feel like you want to wash afterwards.
It's true. It's the stickiest book I've ever written. What's fun is that, you know, coming right after my last novel, Room, which was such a big hit, this novel is at first glance so entirely different. I was not trying to sort of capture the same readership as Room. And yet they've turned out to have a lot of continuities, because really they're both about, you know, young women having babies in desperate situations and doing their best to escape from the situation they've got into. So, you know, the theme of motherhood under tough circumstances turns out to link these novels together in a way I hadn't expected.
Fascinating. So listeners had a blast at the beginning of the show of Dans ma petite quinquin, at the beginning of the interview. And you mentioned the music before, but how important did the music inspire you? Which way round was it?
In a way, the title came first. I wanted a phrase for the kind of grunting sound of lots of frogs, because frogs are not only the animal that Jenny traded in, literally, but they're slang for the French as well.
Yes.
But
yes.
Once I had the phrase frog music, I thought, oh, I'll stick in a couple of songs, you know, because all the characters in the book are performers one way or another. And, you know, I thought it would be an easy way to sort of suggest the multicultural hubbub of San Francisco. And then I got more and more interested in the fact that people were so unselfconscious about performing in those days. People would apparently break into song, you know, on a train or walking down in your local pub. Somebody would be singing the latest opera song. And there was no distinction between high and low culture. Opera was mass media. People sang smutty songs and they would borrow songs from different ethnic traditions. So I absolutely loved mixing in Irish ballads and spirituals and French songs. And I had to make sure that I had, you know, free of copyright texts to quote in the book, because you don't want to annoy record companies by quoting anything which is in copyright. But that made me really trace the history of each song very precisely. And many of them turned out to have sort of crossed over from, say, something would start as a music hall satire and then a few decades later would be sung quite seriously. So songs all have really kind of impure histories. Again, a famous Negro spiritual, The City Called Heaven, that turned out to be a white gospel song that had been borrowed by the black churches. So I just love the muddiness of music and the way it brings people together across these boundaries of identity.
And it must, and before recorded music, of course, everything was live. So it's much more direct and exciting.
Well, it's funny, you know, they'd have a big opera and then the next day they'd be selling the paper music on the street. But often they would have a live singer to sort of promote the paper music. So even when you had forms of reproduction like printed song sheets, there was still this element of the live to how they were sold.
But the colourfulness, it's so vibrant, isn't it?
Mind you, the organ grinders, they sound like they were really annoying. You know, if you had an organ grinder at the corner, apparently they'd put in a big barrel of, you know, the triumphal march from Aida, and they would just crank it out all day, you know. Yeah, so it's a bit like a ghetto blaster set to one particular Eminem track.
So Blanche was a lady of the night, which is kind of performer, prostitute. Can you explain what she did do kind of sexually and stuff? And
sure, well, of course, I didn't know much except that in the inquest about Jenny's death, you know, there were references to Blanche being, you know, a soiled dove or a woman of uncertain virtue or woman of soiled reputation. They used all these different euphemisms, a lady of the night, that sort of thing. And one later historian said, without giving his sources, that she danced in an act called the Three Lively Fleas. So I just had to imagine a career for her. And I decided, because I've written about prostitution before in very grim terms, in my novel Slammerkin, it's a teenage street prostitution. You know, it's all pretty brutal. I thought this time I'm going to make Blanche a genuine, you know, lover of sex who thinks the sex trade is working out just fine for her. She's making lots of money. Yeah. She thinks she's doing it on her terms. Mm. You know, I read accounts by contemporary strippers. Some of them are going, this is a good job. Don't tell us to be either housewives or cleaners. You know, we're making good money. But I wanted to find a moment in the book where Blanche actually starts to question the trade she's engaging in and think, you know what, you know, I'm sick of saying yes. I found a moment where I need to say no. So I thought it would be much more ethically and psychologically interesting to take somebody who starts the novel thinking prostitution is just great. But I totally enjoyed writing her dance scenes. And I found that, for instance, the idea of stripping, like taking off your clothes bit by bit, that's very 20th century. They didn't do that in the 19th century. They wore sexy costumes and danced in them, but they didn't take them off. And the sexy costumes were not at all focused on the breasts. They typically are, you know, covered up to their necks. It's all about the legs. They would have revealed legs, but in tights. And often the costumes have this kind of whimsy that you see in modern burlesque today. So, for instance, I've seen wonderful picture postcards showing burlesque dancers in an outfit with a horse's head or a sort of Xena warrior princess breastplate or a bow and arrow or a little bit of cross-dressing. You know, they'll have a top hat and tuxedo top, but then bare legs. So this immense playfulness about it. And two of the typical dances they did were the skirt dance, where you'd have this massive skirt that you would sort of almost hide behind. And also the tarantella dance, where you'd pretend there was an insect up your skirts and you'd go crazy. That one goes way back. There's even a kind of a cult side to that one, where people used to dance the tarantella to cure themselves of illnesses. So stuff like that, trying to figure out what exactly an erotic dancer did in the 1870s. It's a research challenge that I just love. And I find doing research for historical fiction is a wonderfully free kind of research, because, you know, it's not like writing a PhD, which I have done in the past. It's much more associative. You can follow every interesting tangent. You know, you can spend the day immersed in some tiny particular aspect of the time that you may end up not writing about, but you'll have a richer sense of the time because you've explored it.
Fabulous. Now, Jenny Bonnet. So you do have proof that she was... Have you seen photographs of her in men's clothes?
No, not photographs. The newspapers published one picture of her, but I'm really unconvinced by it. It was after she died, and it looks kind of... She looks sort of baggy and slouchy and, you know, uncool, you know, whereas the way she comes across in the textual evidence is this very sparky figure and very attractive, you know? And... You know, things you might assume about her turn out to be wrong. For instance, when you meet her in the novel, you know, she's cross-dressing and she's no man in her life. But then you find out later that she had a husband before that. So I love the idea of people hiding layers of themselves under a costume or under a persona. And the novel gradually kind of unpeels Jenny to tell us more and more about her.
So do you think she was gay?
You know, I don't think that label fits the times at all.
No,
I really don't.
Even if they were doing it, no one would write it or...
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. I mean, a lot of these labels were around, you know. You could have called... Somebody could have called her a sapphist, or I've got one man in a bar calling her a morphodite, which is like slang for hermaphrodite. Yeah. I think people would have been more likely to comment on her gender bendy than on who she was sleeping with, you know.
So it's public image, isn't it? It's
So I'm really interested in questions of, say, sexuality, but... One thing I like about writing historical fiction is that the labels weren't firmly attached to anyone then.
Yes.
So even if the labels existed, there wasn't this feeling of, what are you? You know,
yeah.
You know, like on Facebook now, you mentioned identify yourself in every way. You know? Though I see Facebook recently caved to the pressure. They brought in lots of different gender identity labels. It used to be you had to say you were male or female. And now they've brought in about 43 different variants.
So which one do you take?
I haven't updated my profile. Yeah. I'd probably just go boring old female, but I'm very interested.
Or wife, you could put.
I could.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station.
Were you nervous about writing frog music after the success of Room?
No. I think when you have a big hit in your 40s, it's delightful, but it doesn't turn your head, you know?
Yeah.
You'd be ridiculous if you let it turn your head and let yourself believe it was always going to be like that. So I write each book out of a spirit of wild enthusiasm, and if it happens to sell well, then it's great as well. But issues of sales are unpredictable, and I could certainly never shape my career around trying to sell well.
Yeah.
Because that would be a sure way to write a bad book.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you. You're the youngest of eight children, and your parents are both teachers, and your father was a literary critic, and you were brought up in Ireland. You are a lesbian. Was it different? Did you come out in Ireland?
Oh, fearfully and nervously, yes, to a few friends in my teens in the 80s. Oh, the atmosphere was really scary, though. You know, it's funny. I don't even remember in Ireland anyone saying anything anti-gay. They didn't need to. You know, you just knew.
You just knew
to be afraid, you know. So I was convinced that if the nuns found out, I would be thrown out of school and so on. So, yeah, I had slowly and painfully come out to everyone in my life by 21. I waited till I'd emigrated until I told my mother, you know, just to hide somewhere to run to. You know, I waited till I was living in England. So I would say it was not an ideal situation. But on the other hand, for a writer, it's great to have a little bit of trouble in your life. Something which makes you feel like an outsider. Mm-hmm. You know, I think writers need that outsider's eye on things. They cannot be too comfortable.
Yeah, and secrecy. And I mean, you know, you've got it all, haven't you? Catholics, nuns.
Indeed, it gives you such a sympathy for, you know, characters who've got themselves into some kind of awful bind, you know. And I think my being a lesbian, I think it gave me a massive interest, not just in women's history, but in all these stories that a culture doesn't get around to telling. You know, I got very interested in race as a category, very interested in disability and people who were put on show as freaks, you know. So I'm very interested in the art.
For instance,
one of the few characters I had to make up for Frog Music was I wanted a journalist, and quite a nice journalist, to be sort of helping to investigate the death. And I'm just getting so sick of the idea of the albino psychopath. You know, it shows up over and over in the Da Vinci Code, so many other text, you know. Ooh, he's albino, he must be a psychopath. So I thought, I'm going to make this perfectly nice journalist an albino, you know, and not do anything freaky with that, just have it be a fact about him. So I'm very interested in the marginal and history's nobodies.
So you live in Canada with Chris, your partner. Is she Canadian?
Yes, but of French and English origin. So she's a, you know, confused immigrant like myself. So that means she totally understands when some days I wake up in the morning and I want to read The Guardian, and not online. I want to read it in a cafe in Cambridge where we met. I spent 8 years in England, you see, before I moved to Canada. So Canada is my second place of emigration. So, you know, sometimes I want to be in some impossible combination of all my home countries.
Yeah, yearning for it all in different levels.
Exactly, yeah. Dissatisfied wherever you go, really.
Yeah, no, I can totally relate to that. What I want to ask you is, why Canada?
Oh, just that Chris had a job to go back to in Canada, a university job with tenure attached, so you can't sniff at that. So, yeah, we've ended up there mostly because of her job, but we're really happy there, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's it like?
I like it very much. It's got a very high level of immigration, you know, so lots of people like myself are new to Canada, and Canada seems to welcome us in, you know? There's no sense of... There's the real Canadians and then there's us, you know.
Right.
They pretty much accept you as a real Canadian the minute you're in the door, you know.
Even without the accent.
Yes, indeed. They would say there's no one Canadian accent. So basically, Canadian identity is very loose and very accommodating. compared with, say, either England or Ireland.
Yeah, definitely. So I was going to say, and you kind of pretty much asked it, what's it like being a gay mother in Canada?
What's great about it is that you get to forget that you're a gay mother. You know? You just think, oh, I must pick up my children from school, you know? And only rarely does anything make you go, you know, just occasionally, say, if one of the kids at my kids' school says to them, how can you not have a father? You know, my kids need to do their roving ambassador bit and explain. It almost never comes up.
Sorry, so have you kind of explained it all?
Oh, that's been part of the storyline from the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And now my kids understand that, you know, some babies are not conceived at the clinic. Some babies are just made at home, you know?
Fantastic.
By accident, even.
But it's really good, especially coming from Ireland and the secretiveness
exactly.
of Ireland.
I mean,
you could
be a lesbian mother in Ireland today, but you'd always be... You know, slightly battling with the forces of darkness.
Slightly. That's very politely put it.
As you're a historical writer, how happy are you that you were born now in a time to be able to write lesbian fiction?
Very happy indeed, yes. I think I would have had to use quite a few euphemistic literary devices in previous eras. And also, you know, much as I enjoy writing stuff set in the past, I can't, you know, the options for women were so narrow in many of the eras I'm writing about. You know, I wouldn't want to have either had to be, you know, a prostitute or a nun. So I think it's splendid that these days you can wear trousers, you can wear skirts, you've got a range of possibilities.
No, it is. I mean, people complain about being a woman, but it is a brilliant time to be a woman,
I think. It is no better, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Gay or straight, we are all fascinated with sexual gender. Why do you think it is?
Well, it's pretty primal stuff, you know, who you love. I think it's fine for us all to be fascinated with it. I just wish people would be more accepting of the unpredictability of people's journeys through life. I mean, I've known so many people who at 20 were firmly gay or straight, and at 40, you know, they may have reversed or just be uncertain about it. So the idea that you have to sort of make up your mind by 20, it's just a nonsense. People go through all sorts of life changes.
Emma Donoghue, it has been a complete joy having you on Radio Gorgeous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Frog Music is out now and published by Picador. This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Dorme un petit quinquin, un petit pouchin, un gros rougin. Te fera de chagrin si tu ne dors point ce canin. Ainsi l'autre jour, un pauvre dentelière, une amie clotant, c'est un petit garçon, qui depuis trois quarts d'heure, une feuille brère, t'a chaud de l'endormir par un canchon. Elle y dit, joue, mais Narcisse, demain t'auras du pain épice, du suc à gogo, si t'es sage et que te fais toto. Tors, un petit quinquin, un petit pouchin, un gros rougin, te me fera de chagrin si tu ne dors point jusqu'à demain.